coming from, trying to take a highly engaging real-world issue and bringing in student voices. Cool. Except the teacher was doing 90% of the talking. Problem was, in this circle conversation that wasn't, there was also a conversation about humanity that really could have been. After a "everyone say something they remember from yesterday" starter, students, pass, pass, I don't know, pass, police? Teacher, yes, and wouldn't it be great if I recap the whole lesson for you for 10 minutes? Whee! They started new material by defining police brutality. As a decent definition was constructed, one student interjected. I'm so scared of police. I'm so scared of dying. I mean, I guess if a cop had their gun on me, I would just close my eyes and think of my family and hope that I died with dignity. Holy shit. This from a student who spent more time out of class than in, who spent more time in class non-subtly referring to weed than actually referring to anything on topic. This from a student who wore class clown status like a shield from sharing emotion. This from a young black male, a student so much like so many faces that had become hashtags in the months and years before. This. And then from the teacher, okay, but Marcus, we're just on the definition now, so hold that thought. Then that. Hold that thought? Marcus deflated, sat back in his seat, said nothing. Within 5 minutes, he was wandering toward the bathroom, then down the hall, then God knows where for the rest of the hour. His moment of honesty, of incredible vulnerability, was shut down so the class could finish a definition. The teacher, one of our school's racial equity leaders, was pulling some straight-up white guy bullshit, the same kind of white guy bullshit I pull all the time without realizing it. By insisting on a linear structure determined by me for an exceedingly complex and personal topic reflected in our students, the other white guy and I found it way too easy to say the word race a lot, so long as we keep teaching in super, super white ways. But hey, we're super anti-racist. We can name the names, we can be angry at the failings of the school system, the justice system, and oh, don't even get us started on the media. In fact, do get us started on it so we can stand in front of a bunch of kids and tell them all the things we think about the way they are portrayed in movies and TV. And your comment is great, but let's stay on topic, because maybe we aren't ready to get that real yet. Because maybe we aren't an expert in you, and we want to stay the expert. We feel that our anger at oppression entitles us to an opinion, but our entitlement is that oppression. When the voices of people of color are being minimized and marginalized, when their experiences are being questioned, when their lives are being devalued, it is by white people. When conversations about race are being derailed or dismissed, it is by white people. When someone is saying, I know your children aren't being fairly educated. I know they're being unfairly arrested. I know nearly every image they see of themselves is a negative one. But this isn't about race. It is a white person talking. It is white people, and it is arrogant, selfish, and ignorant for me to pause those conversations for 1 minute to say, but not me. We police black voices with calls of being impolite, for being unproductive to white listening, for not bringing us along, for showing a fraction of the anger for large offenses that many white voices show for very small ones. We accuse them of being racist for conversations that name race, that don't make room for the devaluing of their children and coddle grown-ass white people who haven't found a moment in life yet to really think about race. We let white people not listen by attempting to translate messages that need no translation. I will keep saying we because I am a white male. The purpose of identifying myself as such is to recognize that as a member of both identities, I am tied to the behaviors, beliefs, and privileges of other people who share those identities, whether I like it or not. I need to understand what it is to be not only white but male, because not understanding does not make a single problem of privilege go away. I am a white male. I rely on white privilege, often, but not always, without recognizing it. I have been dangerous, often, but not always, without intending it. I seek conversations that help me to understand my privilege, and I bristle at actually losing even small pieces of that privilege. When I am not given the chance to speak, I react poorly because I am used to every space being my space. And even in schools where most of our students are people of color, our schools are often white spaces. And even in schools where most of our staff are women, our schools often have male staff, union, and administrative leaders. I've seen disruption, pretty massive disruption caused by enforcing dress codes on female students. Students often, and understandably, react poorly to being told that clothes they have on or body parts they have make them inappropriate for school that day. There are meltdowns, to be sure, and indignation. There is yelling and arguing and many things that are massive disruptions to learning. Sometimes kids go home for the whole day, which is a whole lot of learning not happening. I've seen administrators enter active classrooms, walk around the room sticking their heads under desks to look at the length of skirts and shorts. Really, in the real world, I've seen this. I've seen girls asked to stand up in front of classes, looked up and down, and then told, "Yeah, I guess you're okay. Sit back down." I've watched administrators leave, and then I cared for embarrassed, shamed, angry students. I've seen whole days of learning disrupted. And that doesn't take into account the emotional damage done to students by a system that should be protecting them. I'm uncomfortable with the message we are sending. Kids are self-conscious enough. Girls especially have enough people commenting on how they look and holding them to an often impossible and moving target of appropriateness, attractiveness, and self-expression. I don't like a school telling someone that the clothes they put on their own bodies made them a problem for the whole school they attend, so much so that they need to go home or cover up, so much so that they need to feel shame. Shame disrupts learning more than skirts. I promise. We're more comfortable confronting the girl wearing the thing, and not the boys who say the things about her. We are comfortable putting the blame for the actions of boys onto the girls around them. We support a culture of shame in our schools. We support a culture that says that female bodies are not their own, that females are responsible for the actions of others with regards to their bodies. I don't do that. I swear that I don't. I don't think that I do. And until I was confronted by my student about how big of an ass I can be sometimes to female voices in my room, I would have been sure I was pretty much nailing it. There were men out there that were sexist and shitty, but not me. Not all men, right? So long as I wasn't the one enforcing a shaming dress code, surely I was one of the good guys, right? Way back at that conference group of white guys, I thought hard about what words truly describe white men in the world. I called out, "Dangerous." Dangerous. The group didn't like that, because no one in the group would describe themselves individually as dangerous. But by not all meaning our understanding of what it means to be a man in the world, we imagine that we are somehow immune to the effects of harassment. We can imagine that unless we are active rapists and harassers, that our presence in the world isn't somehow shaped by rape culture, and that our microaggressions of gaze, of bad jokes, of objectification don't somehow feed and support that culture. We need to recognize the experience of girls and women being objectified, catcalled, attacked. We need to recognize our role as the predator, the role as the rapist. We are the person most likely to rape and kill the women around us. I may say a simple hello to a stranger and she may feel harassed. But can a simple hello actually be called harassment? Yes. For two big reasons. One, because she said so. Shut up and listen when people say they feel harassed or offended. And two, because I am not the first man to ever say hello to that woman, and so my interaction carries the weight of other interactions with other men. I should know, if I am listening at all to nearly every one of the women around me, that they have had interactions that started with a hello and have ended in someone invading their space, in someone saying something disgusting, in someone meeting silence or polite refusals with insults, with threats of rape, with bitch. Those interactions carry weight into our classrooms. Those interactions are reinforced by teachers who give equal room to guys who say that women shouldn't be offended by them. It doesn't matter how many times I've seen The Notebook or what feminist writers I follow on Twitter. My intentions don't matter. My history doesn't matter. In that space, I'm dangerous because I'm a man, because men are dangerous in those situations. I should know this. There's no excuse not to know this. White men. We are the beneficiaries of a dangerous, reckless amount of privilege. We are the violent defenders of any threat to that privilege. We are the default, the assumed norm, the humanity through which others are denied full humanity. As a white teacher, especially as a white male teacher, I am the instrument through which many students are introduced to their own marginalization. Any time I spend not recognizing that, any time I spend hoping that if I ignore it, it will just get better, any time I spend not supporting, protecting, and amplifying marginalized voices in my room, it's just straight-up white guy bullshit. When kids work for change. I hate dress codes. I don't see how we have any business as a place people are required to be to tell them how to look when they get there. I don't like schools used as an instrument of shame or cultural supremacy. I hate dress codes, but not nearly as much as a group of girls in my school hate them. The group, which started after one of those, "We're going to go to class and talk about how shoulders are the devil and will make all the boys murder each other and also not do their homework" talks that come around whenever it gets above 60 degrees in Minnesota. As the dress code was applied, unevenly, unfairly, and unkindly, as usual, the group turned from middle fingers under the desk to a full-fledged school movement with a logo. They called themselves the Feminist Killjoys, and it is impossible for me to love anything more than that. Through protest and persistence, they did what so many resistance movements in school fail to do. They created change. They pushed their peers and many staff members to see things differently, and they impacted school policy. Both the what and the why of the dress code shifted. It kicked ass. Students have come to me with all sorts of issues, and it is a powerful and important thing that teachers do to coach their students through bits of life outside of their room. Sometimes, those bits of life include the chance to learn how to stand against what you think is wrong and for what you think is right. Sometimes, kids just have to fuck shit up because they're the only ones smart enough to realize how shitty the shit is. When students come to me complaining about the things in school that drive them nuts, the garbage that stands between them and the school they deserve, I do my best to give them the tools to change what they can without telling them why or what they should change. Basically and radically, I talk to them like they are real, actual people who can make decisions and stuff. Also, I have a lot of faith in young people right now, and they have a lot of work to do to make things better in the world they're building for themselves, and school is a great place to practice. Creating change in a system that celebrates the status quo is a challenge, and giving the right advice to students without taking over for them can make all the difference. What follows is a somewhat formalized version of the advice I give to the kids who care enough to be pissed. Disclaimer. Actions have consequences. Challenging existing power structures is not an activity often met with ice cream parties and awards. You may have people frowning at you. I cannot promise there are not punishments that go along with some of the things I will present as options. It's on you to do things right, to know your school and its rules, and to act in ways that you are ready to accept responsibility for. Hopefully, doing the first options of change well will remove the potential "you're in trouble, mister" options from the table. This information is intended for, and really only useful for, positive action to create a better school. Schools are not perfect places, and sometimes can be wholly awful places. Though our families trust our schools to give their children what is best for them, they sometimes need to be pretty loud about just what that is. Though it should not be the student's responsibility to fix things, sometimes nothing will happen until the wisdom, energy, and organization of young people make it happen. Know your power. When I was in high school, I was a pain in the ass, and I was loud about it. Some things I did well and were helpful, and some things were annoying enough to distract and deter from the intended goal. Now that I've been teaching for a decently long while, I wish I could send a letter to that kid with the pink hair writing articles and organizing protests in his friend's basement. That's what this kind of is. Let me tell you a secret that I doubt is really a secret. Schools are scared of kids. Kids make schools difficult places to run, difficult places to work in. Kids are so human, so full of feelings and histories and constantly evolving lenses through which they see their world. Teaching would be easy if there weren't people involved. But there they are, leaving their backpacks in weird places and falling in and out of love and hate and getting in actual tickle fights with the person next to them and then looking at you like, well, why aren't you teaching? Frustrating though they may sometimes be, students are by far the most powerful group in any school. The whole scale of humans in the building and their power is actually the reverse of what you'd likely think. Administrators sure seem like they've got a lot of power, but their power, like a lot of power, is really dependent on what people are willing to let them do with it. A student alone can only do so much, but in 1,000 ways a day, students show that together they can make a school do whatever the hell they want it to do. Teachers are somewhere in the middle, often far too subject to school happening to them, also gifted with direct connections with kids all day long. Those moments, those kid-to-teacher moments, are the envy of so many administrators and district personnel and lawmakers who wish they ultimately had a fraction of the immediate impact on students that teachers have every day. I think teaching is pretty hard. In fact, the book you're listening to could really be titled, "Welcome to the Shit Show, Plus Jokes." Teaching is tiring and frustrating work, but it's work. It's a place I go to and a place I leave. I think about teaching a lot when I'm not at school, but I don't really need to. Yes, teaching high school is pretty hard, but going to high school is a whole heck of a lot harder. Going to high school means being surrounded by high schoolers, plus teachers, plus administrators and parents, all with 1,000 expectations on how to act, dress, feel, think, not to mention what to read, what to write, and when and how. When you leave the school building, most of those expectations are still there. Except for summer and select exceptional weekends, school is an unfairly large chunk of your whole life. So it's worth having a school that you like. Sometimes that means screwing with the school that you have. Also, students should understand that they have the right to a school that does not suck. School sucks sometimes because it's school, or because you're a teenager, or because life. Sorry. That said, you do have rights. You have the right to a positive environment. You have the right to be free from embarrassment, shaming, or screaming in your school day. You have the right to have your identity, your passions, and your personal history affirmed. You have the right to be heard. You have the right to good classes, good teachers, and work that is good for you. You have the right to be weird and still be treated like you belong. You have the right to use changing your school as practice for changing the world. If you feel like any of those things aren't happening, then you have the right to ask and then demand and then work for and then jump up and down and stomp your feet until those things happen. Here's how. Understand your school. Before you start making change in your school, you need to understand as much as possible about how your school works. This means understanding how the system works, what you can expect as far as support and resistance from people in different roles, and above all else, just how much power students have. So let's start there. It's easy to imagine that students are at the bottom of the power ladder in a building. They are subject to more rules with less input than anyone else, which is why there is so much work that needs to be done. Students have things like detention and suspension. They are subject to grading, and as individuals, they need more from their school than their school needs from them. Remember, a single student may struggle, but a group of students is the most powerful entity in a building. Really, I promise. It's true, and schools hate when students start to figure that out. Schools are given exactly the amount of power students collectively allow. Like I said, I was a pain in the ass when I was in high school. I started an underground school newspaper that was critical of school policies, plus jokes. I organized protests against deteriorating art budgets and fought the school on the censorship of materials in the library. Remember that Rolling Stone cover with the SNL cast dressed as cheerleaders grabbing each other's bits? Yeah, they decried that cover as pornography and tried to have the magazine removed forever. After some lawsuit threats and school board protests, the still ridiculous compromise was reached of putting the magazine behind the counter, available with parent permission. In a district of around 2,000 kids, about half the members of my school board knew me by first and last name. I don't think it was because they liked me very much. Still, I didn't push nearly as much as I could have because I was scared of what they would do to me. Looking back from inside that structure, I realize now I could have done one whole heck of a lot more. When it comes down to it, there's almost nothing your school can do to you unless you break something or attack someone. Don't do those things. Really, seriously, don't break stuff or hurt people. I'm not discounting the whole history of violent rebellion in the world, but as much as your school may suck, your school is not a tool of fanatical fascism. Your school is not stealing your family or cutting off any of your limbs. So long as you don't break the big rules, your school can do almost nothing but frown at you. You can't be suspended for disagreeing. You can't be suspended for asking questions or raising issues. Schools should treat students fairly and respectfully. If they don't, we can fight, but not physically fight, until they do. Sometimes that fight is easier if there are adults on the side of the kids. It's unfortunate and ageist and ridiculous, but sometimes one parent in a principal's office is worth 10 students. It's important to have parents because they may have easier access and a different audience. If the issue is the right sort of issue, you may find a friend in your school's PTO, parent-teacher organization. And certainly they should be interested in the student perspective of whatever story needs to be told. Teachers are pretty restricted in terms of open rebellion. This is my cop-out paragraph, and it's going to be full of the same sorts of cop-outs you will likely hear from lots of teachers. Many teachers have family and mortgages. It may be harsh, but they are not willing to risk those things to fight their bosses on hat rules. When I was in high school, I had a few teachers who I knew were friendly to my various goals, and those teachers were profoundly helpful for talking through my plans and coaching my language on letters, and at least pointing me toward maps of the system I was trying to navigate. When I asked them about their bosses, they would often smile, say they loved their bosses and every decision their bosses made, and show me a picture of their house with their family standing in front. In my high school, our fight was often with admin. Your situation may well be different, though, and those bosses, the administration, may end up being a great help to you. In fact, if you're planning on being or supporting a student activist, it is not a bad idea to seek a positive relationship with your administrators along the way. I've worked with some really brilliant people who run schools, and those people love to hear student voices and student concerns. Principals are people, too. Reach out to them. Be respectful and calm and informed. Trips to the principal's office are a heck of a lot better when you've asked to be there in the first place. Once you've understood the school you're in and the people around you, it's time to pull a chair up backwards with a cup of hot chocolate and have a nice healthy chat with your very own special self and whatever minions you've gathered to your cause. If you are angry, upset, offended, or passionate about your cause, your instinct will be to sit and complain about said thing. It feels good to say something is wrong in front of a group of people, and it feels even better when people in the room nod their heads. Don't get too caught up in this. You have work to do, and your first job is to ask the best possible questions. Ask the right questions. What is the root of the issue? Lots more questions. Is someone not being heard? Not being represented? Does the problem stem from mistreatment or from opportunities being limited? To really fix something, you have to know more than what it is. You have to know where it's coming from. What do you want? Don't stop at what you think is dumb or what you think is wrong. Come up with a plan for how things could be better. Imagine the meetings you may have. Will you be focused on solutions? Will you bring new ideas to the table? I see this a lot in advocating for change in school discipline. I don't like suspensions, and I want suspensions gone. Lots of people want suspensions gone, and can speak at length and loudly about how suspensions should be gone. Awesome! But then what? What next? How do we create a system that isn't punitive and exclusionary and encourages positive growth and support for students? I've been in a whole lot of meetings where no one has an answer to that question, or where people just say, restorative justice, a whole bunch of times without any real plans on how to make that happen on a systemic level. Those meetings don't tend to go anywhere, but everyone feels like they're getting some work done. So that's good, right? People shut down quickly when all you are doing is telling them they're wrong, even if they are wrong. People get defensive when you tell them they've screwed up, even and especially if they screwed up. If you don't need to establish past problems, don't. Focus on moving forward. If all you're looking for is an apology, you likely won't get it. And if you do, an apology to you won't help the next kid. Will what you're doing get you what you want? Anger feels righteous, and breaking rules is pretty fun, but will it accomplish your goals? When I was a teenage rabble-rouser, I always wanted to jump first to whatever action was the most dramatic. Sometimes those things worked, but oftentimes it took a lot longer and a lot more compromise to change things after a loud, messy first attempt. Keep your goal in mind, and make sure your plan is pointed at achieving that goal. The difference sometimes between things that work and things that don't is that things that work take people who work a lot. It's actually pretty easy for a small group of loud people to disrupt the work of others, and the shouting and table pounding will ultimately feel like you're getting something done. It's way harder and less immediately rewarding to build something positive and cool, but the advantage is that you may well be adding something that makes your school better. What is the scope of the issue? Is this a classroom problem, a building or a district problem? Is this regional, national, or global? If this is something just happening in your school or just happening to you, you should look around and see if there are larger issues at play and larger groups you can ally with. If this is a global issue, finding global support may be easier, but you also need to figure out how you can make your issue personal and local to the people you are trying to convince. There is no problem too big or too small for good work to be done, but you should be aware of the size of the problem at hand. Does everyone have all the information? If students are taking issue at the actions of a single teacher, great. Before you move forward with massive protest, does that teacher know? Does their boss? Do they know, and do they know the whole story, and do you? You have strength in your truth, but you compromise that strength when you only share it in pieces or when you tailor it to different audiences. collect and distribute information to all stakeholders. Doing so may just make everything move that much better as you move forward. Information may solve the problem all on its own. Take action. Low-level ruckusing. Get organized. You can do this, whatever this is, alone, I promise you, because you're a beautiful, magical snowflake, and everything is possible, and you can totally change a whole system all by yourself. Still, you should figure out if you have any support, and you should bring those supporters together. Start a Facebook group, an email chain, a Twitter hashtag, whatever works for the people you are bringing together. In drastic situations, you may also consider talking with real humans to their real faces. Organize your allies, your ideas, and your plan of action before you start. Your group needs to decide, 1. What is the problem? 2. What needs to be done? 3. How should we do it? Don't do anything until everyone involved knows the answers to those questions and how you came to them. Communication is organization, and organization is power. Schedule a meeting. There are a few great productive options when you start agitating for change. This means, like all great revolutionaries in history, you have to ask for a meeting. First and foremost, you need to give whoever has the ability to fix the problem a chance to fix the problem. Figure out who that person is and then make sure that person knows who you are. That person may be a teacher, a staff member, a building administrator, a superintendent, the school board, or someone in the state government. When I was your age, you little whippersnapper, that meant writing a letter to a person who talked to the person who might be the person you want to talk to. Now, you have email, and email kicks the ass of all but the most ridiculous bureaucracies. Email someone in charge, introduce yourself, say a bit about the thing you're interested in changing, and ask for a meeting. If they don't respond in a day or two, email again. If they don't respond again, or respond in the negative, find out who that person's boss is, and email that person instead. Wash, rinse, repeat as necessary. When you get a meeting, be sure to use it well. The person you will be meeting with will most likely be a professional meeting being adder. They will want to drive the meeting to fit their needs. Walk in knowing exactly what you want to say and not say. Come with a plan and look for resolutions. Don't waste their time and don't expect that everything will get fixed instantly. They may need some time to think things over and talk to other people. And if you represent a group of people, you should make no final decisions without consulting them. There may need to be follow-up meetings, which may sound super awesome, but be careful. It's very easy to confuse having a meeting with actually doing something. Keep your eye on your goal, and keep working until it's done. Meeting to-dos. 1. Know what you want said. 2. Be confident in your message. Be courteous in your delivery. 3. Listen to what they say. 4. If they promise to do something, write it down and remind them later. 5. Keep pushing. Go public. If meetings aren't working or the people involved refuse to have them, it may be time to take your message public. The advantage of trying to settle things quietly and civilly before you go public is that all those unanswered emails are now ammo to prove you've done things right and have been ignored. If you aren't getting heard in private, go public. Going public can mean lots of things. It may be that news media is already sniffing around the school and all you need to do is raise your hand and step forward. Or it may mean you need to contact them. The problem with jumping toward the media first is that you are ultimately not in control of what they say. Someone's genie wish gave us the internet, bless their heart, and you should use it. Write blog posts, start a Twitter or Facebook campaign. Be funny, be satirical, use art, use your brilliance. If you're not a professional communications person, don't try to sound like one. Sound like you, because authentic communication is way more powerful than hyper-professional communication. That, and it seems like the job of most communications people, is to say as little as possible in as many words as possible. Make sure that anyone who can hear you knows you're someone who should be listened to. Sure, sometimes those people may also be media members, but unless your issue is, I'm never on the news, getting interviewed is not achieving a goal. You need to make sure it helps you get there. Talking to the media is dumb because the media is pretty dumb, and also full of its own agendas and biases. In order to help them be helpful, you should make sure you, and anyone in your group who may get a microphone shoved in their face, have some talking points. What are the crucial things you want to say? Make it simple and say them over and over and over. Video and print media need to pick little clips of what you say, and your hour-long interview will be condensed down to 15 words you only kind of said, unless you give them those 15 words over and over again. But what if your 15 words are great, but no one will listen? Well, the nuclear options. Walkout. There's a lot of reasons that walkouts are dumb, really. I'm not just saying that because I'm an adult and adults always tell kids not to be loud and ridiculous. They don't work because kids walk out and have no idea why. That kid, that one with the hair thing and the shirt and stuff, that kid? That's the kid the news is going to talk to. And there's no way that kid is going to say anything about your issue. That kid just hates biology. I'm not saying don't do a walkout. I'm saying if you're going to do one, you better work your butt off and take the time to do it well, or it may just make things worse. Sit-in/occupy. Like a walkout, if you're going to go there, you need to have all your ducks in a row. And then you need to be ready for your ducks to get in some serious trouble. If you've gotten this far, and nothing has worked, the only way to fight the system is to disrupt it. Fine. But do everything you can to think of a better way first. If you've done the work and there is some seriously unjust stuff happening and nothing is going to be okay until it's fixed, then yes, sit right in the damn middle of that stuff and refuse to move until it gets better. Let me know. I'll come sit next to you. Make change. Disruptive protest is a beautiful thing when it is done for beautiful reasons. If there is great injustice, fight it with greatness, with fierce courage. If the best brains around you are working with you, you can think of a better way to protest than ripping off the 60s. I've heard of schools where students hold workshops for teachers on issues of race and get the leverage from the district to force attendance. Go big, go loud, go brilliant and creative and wonderful. Celebrate the beauty of human voice and experience in the faces of those who would restrain it. Don't just advocate for change. That's what adults who are scared of losing their jobs do. Make change. Make it, and refuse to accept the promise of it at a more convenient time. Push and push until the wall gives way. Part 4. Spring. Like most things in life that prove this is all one big bad joke, you will learn how to best reach and teach your students right as they are getting ready to leave. Do the hard work at school. Don't avoid the places where you struggle. Lean into the impossible things about teaching. Give your room to the kids. When I taught 8th grade, I often organized the graduation celebration. For whatever reason, even though it was just middle school, there was an hour-long arts performance, speeches, diplomas. There was a choir, a band, an orchestra. There was a reception with cake, with powdered lemonade and giant orange coolers, with 3 million pictures and 7 million side hugs. There was honest-to-God sobbing. In exchange for organization, I was often allowed the privilege of avoiding some end-of-the-year stuff I'd rather not do, like watch musicals. I love art. I love kids. I love kids making art. And most especially love the idea of theater and performance and everything it does for the soul in the world. That said, I have never once been in a theater watching a musical and not wanted it to end. So, near the end of 1 year, middle school students were putting on a musical that was some modern retelling of some story I didn't care about anyway. And there was music and a clumsy house band. And I had many things to get ready for the upcoming graduation, so I got to sit in the hallway. As I was shepherding kids into the theater, I grabbed a couple of backpacks away from students, backpacks being the harbingers of hot Cheetos and cell phones and all other things that get in the way of art. The kids went in, sat down to watch the what-have-you, and I sat on the floor with a laptop and started some comparison sheet cake shopping. While choosing between cakes that looked like non-food and other cakes we couldn't afford, I noticed a distinct smell coming from the bag next to me. The smell, most familiar to me from my days going to fish shows, I don't want to talk about it, and from the moments just before my friends got kicked out of my freshman dorm, he'd rather I not talk about it, was unmistakably illegal. I grabbed the bag and went to the office. I'm about to find some weed, I told our assistant principal, and I'd rather not find it alone. Weed was found, and the student was retrieved from the play. Bringing the bag to the office removed me from responsibility, which was nice, but also removed me from control of what happened next. While sitting in the office, the student was grilled with real, actual anger and scariness by an administrator who seemed intent on cracking a drug ring that did not exist. She kept signaling me to join in on the berating, and I tried to speak up in defense of the kid. Way too late. The cops were called, and they did some more scary yelling. The kid was sent home by way of the police station. By the end of the day, we were told the student would not be allowed back in our building. Ever. We were 3 weeks from the end of school, and this student would simply be considered finished with middle school and sent on his way. He would not be welcomed in the building for graduation, for the final dance, or as a participant or audience member for any of the final arts performances. My team and I threw some fits, but were ignored. We tried and tried to at least let the kid who had been a member of our school for 5 years, at least come to the graduation. Nope. As a final and fruitless show of protest, we read his name at graduation after being told not to, and took a half second to recognize the member of our community who wasn't there to join us. I don't know. It was bullshit. It was bullshit, and I felt like it was my fault. Looking back, I'm still not sure what I should have done differently. For a moment, I thought it would have been relatively amusing to take the weed from his backpack and flush it, but not say a word. He would know I knew, and I would know he knew that I knew. But we could leave it at that. I'm pretty sure I could get fired for that, though, and also pretty sure I should be fired for that, so it's a less than perfect option. I thought about different administrators I could have taken the bag to who may have handled it differently, or ways I could have at least tried to keep the cops out of it. I think a lot still about how I could have just ignored it. Could have just smelled something from a bag that was most likely weed, decided not to make a big deal about it, and go back to a universe where shopping for crappy cake was the biggest issue of the day. I'm not sure what's right. I'm not sure what I would do now if given the chance to go back. My best guess is that I would just let it go. Honestly, I don't think weed is that big a deal. I still think about it, years later, and continue to 1/1,000,000th guess my decision. The backpack happened while I was in my 5th or so year of teaching, and I had fallen into an uneasy balance of being generally laid back about things while being an absolute hawk about broken rules and extremely talented at catching kids doing the stuff that kids do. In college, I worked at a record store. If you are unsure about what a record store is, use your internets for fun historical pictures of these crazy places. I was a goofball most of the day, would often skip half of the jobs I was supposed to do, was professional, friendly, and knowledgeable with customers, and was absolutely the best employee at catching shoplifters. Also, after catching them, I would often grab a few CDs and exchange them for a sub or some coffee with another college-age degenerate worker from a nearby business. I was, on balance then, a pretty shitty employee. I was, in my 5th year of teaching, pretty much the same way. I was a great enforcer of rules, a great breaker of rules, and a goofball in all the times between. After my zeal for enforcement led to a kid ending the day at a police station instead of school, I started to really think about how power and enforcement are structured in schools, and remembered why I really hated being a student. It took me 5 years, which makes me kind of an asshole. I get that. Recently, I was sitting with a coworker in a meeting of regional minds calling for dignified behavior interventions in public schools, like ones that don't involve handcuffs. We were among the few teachers there willing to work against our own power in the school system and work for schools that we would have wanted to attend. My coworker called the process, he was hitting it after only 3 years to show off, a re-radicalization, which I liked. I called it pulling my head out of my ass, but we meant the same thing. It is so, so ridiculously easy to spend our time and energy as teachers making our job easier. Since our job very often feels impossibly hard, the time feels well spent. In my state, teachers' unions started because schools were death traps for everyone in them. Teachers formed together and demanded, essentially, that someone come in and pound down the nails sticking out of the seats and quit heating the buildings by throwing oily rags in a pile of naked coals in the middle of the floor. It was a difficult fight, and one that makes me proud to be a unionista, which I think is actually a word, though I would prefer unioneers, as it suggests the addition of a rocket pack. Our union still does much the same work, pushing for schools that are better because, at least metaphorically, there are still plenty of nails sticking out all over the place. Sometimes we do other work that mainly serves to make my life easier. We say over and over again that what is best for teachers is best for students. More and more, I would like to see our narrative change, ever so slightly, by switching the order of the roles and demanding what is best for students, because it will be good for teachers. The yelly rhetoric response goes, "You can't put students first if you put teachers last." Good bumper sticker. What I'm trying to do, though, is just knock teachers, specifically the one in my classroom, down to second. In my own classroom, it has meant actively giving away power and decision-making to my students. It's meant making my job harder. For example, and you may disagree with my example, and so may I by the time you hear this, because I'm still figuring things out. I've essentially eliminated due dates on assignments in my room. There is a certain time frame that we will work on a certain project and then move on, but students are free to continue working on that project until they feel done. That way, if all goes well, students are given the best chance to be the most successful on everything they hand in. It's kind of a nightmare. On due dates, about 1/4 of my students hand their work in. That number gets better after a week, but there are always 4 or 5 students per class who do not hand anything in until they are absolutely forced by the end of the quarter to do so. This means that I very rarely get to sit and get grading done during a chunk of time, which is my favorite way to grade. I grade constantly, little bits at a time, across multiple projects. Constantly. I could argue that the approach tires me out and keeps me from focusing properly and is therefore bad for students, though the extra time and flexibility have been very good for the quality of student work and the number of student breakdowns. I could argue that what is best for me are due dates with strict deadlines because I get to organize my life better, and a happy teacher means happy students. I could argue that, but it would be bullshit. Lazy bullshit. There are 2 reasons I honestly want to change. 1, it's a lot of work, and 2, it just doesn't feel like normal school. Reason 2 is also why I feel I'm onto something. I have colleagues who hate the approach and likely aren't too keen on me in general. They say that I am not preparing students for college due dates and late work policies. They are right. I am not. I would like to, but I would also like them to get into college based on their skill level. And strict due dates and late work penalties were making some students who could create and think at an A level get terrible grades in class. I was also getting a lot more work that was half done or rushed or just generally pretty crappy. I still get some of that work, but not as much. I think my system works for kids. I grade them on what they're able to do so their grade reflects their skill in my class, not their ability to organize themselves or follow due dates. Those things are important, but my class is English, not English and study skills. It's a nightmare of grading and scattered assignments, but it's better for the kids I have, so I'm trying it out and trying to make it better. Kids need more than better grades, though. We may forget it too easily, but it's really damn hard to be a teenager. When you look at the structure of schools, it's pretty obvious that we plan our schools thinking of the system, thinking of the time and effort that will be put into management, and thinking of many sets of people before we think of students. If we were truly planning a school for students, for what is best for the reckless shitstorm of adolescence, how long would the break between classes be? When would school start? What sorts of projects would we do, and what tools would we have to do them? I understand it would be nearly impossible to provide a school that is perfect for every individual student, but what if we actually tried? Actually held every adult in every building to a code where every conversation, even the ones where no one else is around, is actually centered on students. I just finished a year with one of the most talented students I've ever had. I had the student in 8th grade before I was moved to the high school in time to have him again in 10th and 11th grades. As a middle schooler, he was a funny kid. He wrote short stories in his free time that he almost never let anyone see. And he drew with the same sort of furrowed, anxious mania that I adopt while writing. This year, though, was different. During the very first day of school, he came into my room before class started. He told me that during the hour he may need to answer a phone call. If you could see the look he gave me, the glassy panic of his eyes, you would have said yes, too. The call came. He went to the hallway quietly. A few minutes later, he was back in my room. A staff member had seen him on the phone and asked to see it. He showed them the phone, proving that it was a family member calling. But the staff member calmly hung up the call, took the phone, and walked away. The family member was calling, just by the way, from court, where the student's parents were fighting to keep custody of him. The staff member didn't ask that, though. What followed that day, and much of the whole year, was a school so intent on system that it ignored the person being batted around by it. Within a month, the student was effectively homeless, living with almost no possessions in another city, taking public transit an hour and a half every day to and from school. His life, his daily normal life, would be an emergency for any of the adults he came into contact with at school. And they all knew it. And they all kept marking him tardy, docking for late work, shaming for work undone. The kid just needed 1,000 hugs a day and a little bit of credit for being smart as shit and having a really bad year. In my class, he got that as much as I could give it. He was writing essays in 8th grade that would have gotten him A's in 11th grade, so I wasn't crazy about super long essays. I made sure he picked up the new ideas we were working on, but never gave him anything to take with him when he left. I would check his grades regularly and would sometimes let him use time in my class to make up stuff from other classes. Every so often, I would take him out to lunch so he could talk about his plans. He used what time and resources he could to start putting together a professional portfolio. He started lining up some places to show his work. He got himself enrolled in college classes while in high school so he could start getting credits before he had to pay for them. He knew full well that when he turned 18, he would be on his own, and he was getting himself ready for it. With no real home, no money, and little more than was in his backpack, he was getting ready for the life he should have. Very, very little of what he did all day at school was helping him on his way. I wondered often if I would give this treatment to all my students, or if it was just that this kid was this kid. I hope to hell I would. I hope to hell I do. This treatment, by the way, was not just me going easy on him. What I was doing, or attempting to do, was going as hard on him as he needed me to be. What I was doing was trying to really meet the kid where he was and give him what he most needed from my class. That's different for every kid, and a ton of work to figure out and manage, but it's not anything more than we should be doing. Our kids are phenomenally good at telling us what they need so long as we're good at listening. But what would happen if we really gave our students the room to do what they wanted? I mean, there are few things scarier to me than losing control over absolutely anything. This is true about everything from hall passes and seating charts to choice books and projects. Even, maybe even especially, when a student is working on something especially cool, my instinct is to butt myself in and make it even more cooler. I fight that instinct, and I'm often rewarded when I give my kids that space. Empowered kids are messy as hell, though. I know how to do things the other way. I know how to do worksheets and checklists in a way that really feel like learning, but pretty much isn't. I know how to get a classroom that is quiet, full of kids doing today's task, filling in blanks from the word bank. It feels like a thing, and it pulls the line up a little from the worst-case scenario of kids not doing anything in your class. Your best-case scenario, though, is nothing much better than completion. Most worksheets beg your kids to copy from one another and extend a hearty invitation to not worry too much about thinking today. When pushing for more autonomy and creativity from kids, you may even hear them complain. I've certainly gotten, "Why can't we just do a worksheet?" more than a few times. And good God, think about what that student is really asking. Their life would be easier, contained in 45-minute chunks of task completion. And my life would involve stacks of sheets to be graded off a master. And then what? It can feel like success, but we can all do better. One of the best days of teaching I've ever had was the day I completely lost control of a classroom. On the last day of the school year, my juniors were taking a final. This final would be a culmination of that semester's work and worth at least a letter grade up or down in their final grade, so, you know, no big deal. Great day to lose control. My final was pretty cool, too. Students were reading two articles written that week that both talked about students in our state. One was quite positive, the great potential of youth and how much we disservice them by expecting too little from them. They ate it up. Sweet. The second was from a local paper about all the problems at a high school a few miles away. That article was not so sweet and referred to the taming of students and generally cast young black kids as inherently violent and scary, while extolling the white teachers who worked with them as blameless victims. My students spent the hour identifying word choice and phrases that built each piece's perspective on students and blah, 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 quiet time finaling. Well, most of my students did. In one class, we had about 5 minutes of quiet time before Ariana, from one corner of the room, shouted out, "Oh, hell no!" Within the next 5 minutes, the whole class was grouped around one big table and were absolutely demolishing the second article. As a group of young, predominantly black students, they had heard these lies told about them all too many times to not catch the weight behind each assumption made in the article. We need to do something. Not learn something, not complete something. Do something. Do. So they did. They informed me, quite respectfully, but firmly, that they wouldn't be doing the final that day. Instead, they were going to spend the hour working together to draw attention to the racist garbage in front of them, and push a narrative of young black kids that reflected them much better. They talk like this because I'm fucking awesome at teaching. Just kidding. They really are that smart. I think I could have pulled them back if I really wanted to. If I held the grade above their heads and shouted them back to their seats and all that stuff, they would have done the final. But holy shit, why? Instead, they put together and revised an action plan that put their voices into the real, actual world. Part of it was to tweet through the hour and include the writer of the piece and try to bring her to recognize the issues in what she wrote. They started by drafting tweets like, "You suck and should never write anything ever," and "This is racist bullshit," and a sort of best of both worlds. "You suck, and so does this racist bullshit." Their leaders forced revisions, though. They recognized that starting with rudeness and swearing was only going to hurt their point in the eyes of many, so they tried to strategize about what to say. "Wouldn't it be fucking dope?" said Ariana, one of the smartest kids I've ever taught, and also one of the very, very worst at turning in homework, and also the central leader of this finals rebellion, and also a prodigious swearer. "If we just tweeted her words right back at her, just to highlight how dehumanizing it is?" Everyone got on board, and the Twitter storm started. I sat behind my desk, mostly sure I wouldn't be fired on the last day of school, and so ridiculously proud of my kids, who, it should be noted, entirely fulfilled the purpose of the original final by showing their mastery of that semester's central themes and skills. But whatever. The kids ran the show. The show ran better because of it. The final became a day worth remembering, and a day that validated their ability to lead and to engage in the real world. It was a small piece of a dream that schools exist entirely for kids. A small step toward a classroom, at least, where that can be true. Liberal racism, racist racism, and the middle road. I haven't been a very good teacher over the past few days. I've been quick to anger. The kind of anger that has led to my standing in front of the classroom speaking earnestly about why it's important to just please, for the love of God, let me say one complete sentence. Yesterday, a student was almost 5 minutes late to class. I let it go. The student started talking to the person next to her as soon as she sat down about a girl who said a thing to another girl who said something about that other girl who was a bitch. I asked for their attention for a moment. The student took out her phone and I was done asking. I told her to put her phone away, look up at me, and pay attention. The student put the phone away and put her head promptly down on the table while not so quietly remarking, "Fuck this shit." I told the student to get her head up and launched into a speech to the class, but obviously directed at said student, about how the class is more than one person, about my expectations for behavior and engagement, how everyone needs to live up to at least the bare minimum expectations of blah, 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 because we have real work to get done here, everyone. I was being a pretty crummy teacher at that moment. I was calling the student out, and I could feel her anger growing to match my frustration. In the back, I saw a student nodding her head along with me. She was happy I was calling out a student who had disrupted many of her classes, a student who was more than occasionally open about not caring about school or anyone in it. The student in the back thought I was being a pretty great teacher at that moment. So a tricky, weird, shitty part of me felt emboldened by the approval of the good student and justified in calling out the bad student. We were bonding in our whiteness and in our tacit approval of maintaining cultural whiteness in the classroom. This shit happens all the time. It's hard to be honest about that part of me, it really is. It's really hard to be honest about how deeply racist dynamics permeate my teaching and classroom, but it's what happens. And most of my work revolves around trying to cut that shit out. My journey as an anti-racist teacher started in my very first years through open, challenging conversations with coworkers and students. When I was first introduced to equity work, it was through conversations with adults, intelligent, emotionally invested adults doing very good work. It didn't do a ton for me. Being raised in a nearly all-white town in what may well be the whitest state in the nation, Wisconsin, the Polka State, I was defensive about race. When I started teaching in Minnesota, the other white state, I kind of just wanted the conversations to go away so I could go back to doing what I was doing. I learned the right things to say to get through it, but I wasn't really feeling it in my gut. Later that year, my class combined with social studies in a big room of students engaged in very similar conversations about race and privilege. We gave them structure and a space and did very little as teachers over the next week other than point at who was going to talk next. I actually almost never did that. I listened and listened to my students explain how their skin color changed the way teachers saw them and treated them. I listened to young black males recognize that they were rarely put near other black males in seating charts and class assignments because they were seen as threatening when in groups. I listened to students talk about being put in lower reading groups when the teacher found out their parents spoke Spanish. I listened to stories about suspensions, listened to stories of cultural supremacy masquerading as colorblindness. I watched the faces of white students as their black friends shared stories with the whole room that showed a reality they had never grasped. I watched as white students, catching on far more quickly than I did, were able to articulate places in their lives where they were given the benefit of the doubt, the automatic acceptance that their classmates weren't getting. I began to understand whiteness as a racial identity, that my skin color had often given me privilege and power, often without my asking. It's a difficult thing to understand intellectually during a conversation, but I found it even harder to carry my privilege daily in my awareness. I still struggle with that, with recognizing how race and culture can give a weight and history to a situation that I am not likely to feel. I tried to apply my developing understanding to my practice, and tried to structure my teaching in a way that worked against systemic racism. My first attempts were clumsy and counterproductive. I tried to connect the lyrics to Drop It Like It's Hot to the sonnets of Shakespeare. We studied the racism of World War II Germany and apartheid South Africa without authentically linking it to student experience. It was effort without understanding. I tried, oh how I tried, to be down with my black kids. I sought the approval of my black students as proof of my non-racist status. When Andrew or Brady walked by me in the morning, I would greet them, "Good morning." But when it was Julian or Latrell, I dropped my voice an octave and tipped my chin up and said, "What's up, man?" And I can't tell you how silly I sounded and currently sound when I try to talk like I'm a cool guy over here. I'm with it. While talking with colleagues who are people of color, I kept reaching for the right thing to say or do that would graduate me from equity work. That thing never came, so I continued to grow and grow and push and grow and reflect on my practice, and I began to address race on a deeper level. I added a quarter-long unit that studied and validated different dialects of English and focused on the concept of code-switching between dialects. I use my class now as a way to teach students how racism operates, teaching them the concepts of marginalization, dehumanization, and misrepresentation. I try to give them tools to understand and dismantle racism in media, but I still struggle to infuse those lessons with concrete examples of how race operates in systems of power. I understand personal relationships as a key, but see the difference between being a cool teacher and a respected one. I understand that there is no set of mores, morals, or behaviors that captures every student from every cultural group. No certain reason that each black, brown, or white student acts the way they do. Anti-racist teaching is a process. It is a process without end, without a graduation and certification as officially anti-racist, which is all the better reason to work with urgency. A fully anti-racist school does not exist yet, and it won't until we figure out what one even looks like. Every step down the road is difficult. I'm constantly afraid of saying the wrong thing, constantly afraid of making mistakes, but I don't know another way. So I keep saying the wrong thing, keep doing some wrong things, and keep listening and reflecting when students are telling me something needs fixing. White people, I being among the whitest, are always reaching for how to lead things. We are the ones in the building who take the half-day equity training and then decide everyone else is mega-racist and we should be in charge of fixing them. We want to lead because we are often handed positions of leadership, but really? The most effective work I've done has been shutting the fuck up and making space for others. I'm at my particular point in my journey, and the view from where I am changes regularly. I have no idea if anything I think is right, but they're the rightest things I've found so far. This isn't a chapter of answers. I do not feel I've reached the end of the road, and I often need to turn around to pick things up I left behind. At this point, I am at an intersection in my practice, a sharp right or left turn, and I'm trying to figure out how to go down the middle. The sharp right leads to a reinforcement of an already dominant white cultural norm. In terms of my classroom, it means that when a student is talking in my class, or openly defiant in any way, I respond with rigidity. 1 minute late to class means a call home. Talking while I'm talking? Step outside. Disrespectful when I talk to you outside? Down to the principal. The structure of school is designed to give me the power as the instructor to forcibly apply what some would call classroom culture or school culture, but which almost always plays into quiet is best, compliance is respect, white cultural norms. The sharp left is what is often called liberal racism. This term means that I recognize the many hurdles of microaggressions and the high wall of institutional generational racism placed before my students of color. When they are a minute late, I say, "Well, strict time structures are not common in the cultures of people of color." Or, "My cool black friend," I hope he's my friend,